Last month, the Royal Veterinary College in London hosted a conference called Animal Machines of the Future. It was sponsored by CABI, the Commonwealth Agricultural Bureau International. It's an NGO which focuses on agricultural development and the environment. And the conference marked the 50th anniversary of an iconic book. It was Ruth Harrison's Animal Machines. And that book really started off the discipline that I'm talking about this afternoon, animal welfare science. Animal Machines contained a preface written by another commentator on 20th century agriculture, Rachel Carson. Carson's Silent Spring became emblematic for the environmental effects of industrialised agriculture and the widespread use of pesticides in particular. In Animal Machines, Ruth Harrison was essentially writing the animal side of that same agricultural story. Her book was very widely serialised in newspapers and generated a significant public response, which led to the formation of the Bramble Committee, whose remit was to examine the plight of animals in agriculture. So my purpose in this paper is to look at the role of experiment in the research agenda that derived from the Bramble Committee's report. Because animal welfare science didn't, of course, come from nowhere. And there was one particularly important historical precursor that had a major impact on the new discipline. Animal behaviour research has a long history, which there's not time to go into here. But in the 1950s, behaviourists started looking at domestic animals more. Now, at this period, we didn't have the mandated science of animal welfare science, but rather a loose collection of different behaviourally orientated sciences, such as ethology, psychology, and neuroscience. And their agendas were largely set by curiosity-driven research in sort of standard mode. And a key figure at this time was David Wood Gush, who in 1952 was appointed to research applied animal behaviour at the Agriculture Research Council's Poultry Research Centre, the centre that Miguel mentioned a few minutes ago. And his work and the context is very ably summarised in that paper I've referenced there by Alistair Lawrence, which is a transcript of Lawrence's 2006 Wood Gush Memorial Lecture for the International Society for Applied Ethology. So he was one of a number of scientists whose work began within the field of animal behaviour, but was then subsumed into the new discipline of animal welfare science post-Bramble. Essential to the new approach and the Bramble Committee's remit was a debate on what welfare actually meant and how it could be quantified. And it's an interesting question, and one that is by no means resolved. It encompasses animal health and pathology, ethics, human-animal relations, animal agency, the relationship between facts and values, and above all, how one might define what a good life for animals might entail, because that's inherent in the name. When we investigate animal welfare, we essentially ask, is an animal literally faring well? And that's quite a challenging methodological problem. Science is concerned with stabilising concepts which are amenable to its particular methodologies. One of the interesting things about animal welfare science is the different methodologies that coexist or compete in an attempt to do this. So I'm just going to look at a couple of them. That's a table whose data show the effects on the growth rate of broilers, which are chickens reared for meat, being kept at four different concentrations of ammonia in the air. Now, the first time you walk into a broiler shed, the thing that strikes you, apart from low levels of light, is this sensation of ammonia being present. And it comes from the litter which the birds are kept on, and it's maintained throughout their growing cycle of 7 weeks or thereabouts. So you can see from this experiment that at 50 and 75 parts per million, there's an appreciable negative effect on growth rate and that more birds die. So data like this are used to set a standard of ammonia concentration to be allowable in broiler sheds, and that can inform guidance or legislation if appropriate. So this type of experiment is quite attractive. It gives a clear result, and it's based on a value-free, positivist outlook, which uses growth as an indicator of welfare. Similar parameters could be production, as in milk production in dairy cows, or reproduction, as in the numbers of healthy offspring produced. In other words, if an animal is growing and producing well, it's faring well. Its welfare is good. And this type of methodology comes out of animal science, or animal technology, sometimes called animal production science, and it's a prominent argument within the overall debate in various manifestations it occurs. I heard it given by a pig producer just a few weeks ago. And it is a valid argument. However, there are some issues, some problems with it. Both of the animals on the top of that slide are growing or producing well, but they're not faring well. The broiler chicken has grown so well that it can no longer stand up because of its mass. And the dairy cow in that picture, and that is a pretty extreme example and fairly rare, is under extreme physiological demand to produce milk. If you compare her udder with the 1930s dairy shorthorn cow down the bottom there, you can see there's quite a marked difference in overall body shape and morphology, and that's a modern dairy cow standing beside there. So there's a kind of it's talked about a wedge shape that a good producing dairy cow should have. If you look at the overall shape, there's a sort of wedge from the head to the back end. If you look at the 1930s dual-purpose cow, which was kept for milk and meat, it's a kind of squarer animal overall. So high-yielding dairy cows live on a physiological knife edge. Due to breed selection, their milk production is so high that in extreme cases, at peak lactation, they literally can't afford to sleep. Metabolically, they have to keep eating in order to keep the production up. And mastitis and lameness are difficult problems associated with high production and well recognised as such. Some advocacy organisations have characterised the extremely high-yielding modern dairy cow as lame, tired, hungry and sick. So despite the relatively straightforward and value-free concept and its utility under some circumstances, production as a one-stop measure of welfare has problems, and that it was ruled out on that basis quite near the beginning by the Bramble Committee, as shown in that quote there. Production privileges basic health parameters, but avoids any meaningful consideration of affective states or animal feelings. And this, in essence, is the farm animal trapped in a barn environment that Harrison so trenchantly criticised. The fact that it's putting on weight or making milk is not enough to constitute a good life. So another approach to welfare that offered some potential to engage with affective states in animals, but within the body, is the security of an established body of real science, if you like, arose out of research which had begun in the golden era of endocrinology in the first half of the 20th century. So the hormones insulin, thyroxine and cortisone were all discovered round about this time. And Christopher Nordland has written about this period as a hormonal utopia, where it was thought that by discovering these hormones and how they work and adopting either usage of them or inhibitors of them, you could kind of perfect the body and heal all of its ills. It was a very optimistic time. And in the 1920s, Walter Cannon, an American physiologist, had described the sympathetic nervous system, which literally means with feeling. And then Hans Selye elucidated the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which led to a surge of interest in identifying biochemical markers for stress arising from either physical or psychological factors or the environment. So if we could identify stress in an animal or indeed a human, then that could be an indicator that welfare was being compromised. And research methodologies in animal welfare science began to revisit the concept of stress in the period I'm talking about, which is the 1950s and so on. So this is, it's harking back a little bit to this period of endocrinology. So a sudden change of temperature, constant threat from a dominant animal in a group, loneliness, grief when separated from their young, rough handling by humans, any of these might trigger what became known as the stress response, implying a kind of final generic common pathway and a measurable biochemical result in terms of free hormone or metabolites that could be analysed in blood or urine, faeces, and later saliva. So in animal welfare, there were many experiments like this one, which shows that tethering sows in stalls, in other words, keeping them tied up all the time, stresses them. If we use corticosteroids, cortisone, as a measure of stress. But the results show that tethering certainly causes more steroids, but what might be considered the most naturalistic response for sows, being out in a paddock, also has a steroid response. So quantifying the response became an issue of debate, and also the question of whether stress was always inherently a bad thing. The terms eustress, meaning good or useful stress, and distress for bad stress, which were coined by Celia in an attempt to rescue the concept from increasing confusion, didn't really solve the issue. Nor did the assertion made in 1990 by John Barnett and Paul Hermsworth that a 40% or more increase in free steroids incurred detriment to the animal and could constitute a general risk to welfare. It had all the attractions of a simple quantifiable test, but all the problems and complications too. However, a bit like the production parameters, when used appropriately and because of the association of these hormones with emotions such as pain and fear, the so-called fight or flight response, stress steroid measurement was used quite a bit. And you can see that the two approaches just mentioned are really quite similar and relate to basic health and functioning. The elusive but central question of what the animal was actually feeling was not really being addressed directly. And some, following positivism, argued that that was right and proper, that such a question was beyond the remit of any scientific inquiry. However, many welfare scientists insisted that attempts had to be made to engage with the subjective state of animals if any meaningful assessment of welfare was to be made and measured. And indeed, one of the scientists on the Bramble Committee, William Thorpe, who wrote a very interesting addendum to the main report, raised the possibility of asking animals what environments they preferred by means of carefully chosen experiment. Thus, the animals would demonstrate their agency and in so doing inform decisions over how they would like to be kept. So how could such needs and wants be measured? One approach was illustrated by David Wood-Gush, who I mentioned at the beginning, working with Ian Duncan. They postulated that battery hens would feel frustration if they could not find a secluded nest box in which to lay. With hens, when hens are in a battery cage, they're in a small cage with a number of other hens on a wire floor, and there's no nesting facility. So they wanted to look at this. And their first step was to isolate frustration as a hen emotion. They did this by allowing hens access to a large meal at a certain time of the day in a recognisable container, and they did this repeatedly, so that the hens became accustomed to seeing this container and eating from it. And once they demonstrated that the hens had made that connection, the researchers presented the container, but with a transparent cover on top, so that the hens could see the food but not reach in to eat it. They then carefully catalogued the various behaviours which the hens displayed, which included things such as bouts of displacement preening. So the hens would preen themselves in a kind of unusual and inappropriate way. They would demonstrate aggression to other hens, and they would show stereotypical walking patterns amongst an array of other factors. Having mapped onto these frustration onto these specific actions, they then turned their attention to the regular battery hens and identified the same behaviours being demonstrated around the time of lay, because these hens had no access to a nest box. So this kind of retrograde observation indicated that the hens were being emotionally thwarted in respect of something they wished or were driven to do, and which seemed a fundamental part of their behaviour repertoire. So the hen's affective experience was being mapped across two qualitatively similar events. And these types of experiments across a range of species could become highly sophisticated. Okay, I was going to mention another experiment that Marion Dawkins did, which can be mentioned in the discussion, but I'll push on just because of the time issue there. If we look, so I'm just going to quickly mention these methodologies and then come to a kind of try and make some statements about it. So if we look across animal welfare science as a whole, we can detect three overlapping domains: animal bodies, health, disease, ammonia levels and so on, animal minds, feeling pressure and suffering, and animal natures to do with natural living conditions. And if you look across the discipline, you can see that experiments map into some of these areas and that there's also considerable overlap as well. And it's much more, each area itself has got a spread of approaches as well, it's simplified. So, okay, I want to use the last 5 minutes just to make some conclusions and statements. So animal welfare is a social, political and philosophical construct. If I went to colleagues at Roslin Institute, for example, and said that that's what they were, that their laboratory life was all about, they'd probably beg to differ, although maybe people in this audience would have less of a problem with that. But there is a tension existing between the two concepts, animal welfare and science. In fact, for much of the later 19th century, the concepts of animal welfare and science were diametrically opposed. The smooth, cool men of science in Hilda Keane's paper on the feminist and socialist response to vivisection were the antithesis of what animal welfare meant at that particular moment. So experiment was central to Victorian physiology, but the relationship to animal welfare was very different to the one I'm talking about in the 20th century. That is the move to turn animal welfare into a science, and the location is not the lab, but the animal farm. Harrison, in turning the ethical gaze towards farm animals, preempted the philosophical debate on animal rights, which was began in the 1970s, in Peter Singer's book, 1974, Animals, Men and Morals, which started off the philosophical debate, was 1971. The move to engage with animals' affective states, which was written into the agenda set by the Bramble Committee, can be said to demand a different sort of science, which avoids, for example, the atomistic breakdown of behaviour into stimulus and response reactions, which work additively. Instead, the emphasis is placed on a more unifying theory of animal feelings and emotions, which then can inform approaches. So it's centred around affective states. The work of Jane Goodall is very similar, has that kind of narrative richness. So if we look at animal welfare science, these approaches, which might be broadly labelled feminist, I guess, within the history of ideas, seem to offer some scope for some interesting and important questions. And there have been bold explorations into this type of territory, and it kind of maps on to the ethical debate. One of the problems that feminist care theory has with the two main theories of animal rights, formal animal rights, or utilitarianism, as promoted by Singer, is that it's too rational. It doesn't account for our relations with animals. It doesn't reflect the richness of our relations with animals. So we can kind of see that in a way in this discipline of animal welfare science as well, where we're looking at affective states or where we're looking at health parameters and so on. They map together quite nicely in that sense. And I think, actually, I will just stop there. My timing wasn't very good there, but I'll leave it there and see you.
Thanks very much.